Let me state, as I have every other meeting that we've had, certainly it's good to have you this evening. Appreciate the sacrifice on your part, many of you driving a long distance to be here. And the encouragement that you lend to these efforts is not only noticed, but very deeply appreciated. I would like to talk to you for a moment this evening about terrible lizards. In Job 12, verse 7, "But ask the beasts, and they will teach you, and the birds of the air, and they will tell you." Let me give a little history to introduce our plans for this evening. In 1822, Gideon Mantell, who was a British obstetrician and fossil collector, went with his wife, as his wife went with him, as he was going to examine a patient. They made house calls in those days. And while he examined the patient, his wife strolled past a pile of stone outside in which there were some objects that looked like huge teeth embedded in rocks, huge teeth sticking out of rocks. And at a nearby quarry, they found more teeth and some fossilized bones. And he took it to some other scientists who examined them, couldn't really tell what they were. But finally, a fossil expert believed they were the teeth of a rhino and the bones of a hippopotamus. Dr. Mantell believed they were the remains of a giant plant-eating, reptile-like animal that he named Iguanodon, which means iguana teeth. At the same time, huge bones and teeth were found in Oxfordshire, and they were thought to have come from a megalosaurus, megala meaning, of course, huge, big, and saurus. The saur always refers to a lizard, so some kind of a giant lizard-like animal. By 1841, Sir Richard Owen had examined so many of these fossils. He was the leading British anatomist at this time. And as he looked at these, he concluded that there was a huge population of lizard-like reptiles that had once lived there. So the date's debated. Some say 1841, some say 1842. I think it's probably 1842. He named them dinosaurs. And, of course, if you look at the word, the saur, we've already pointed out, always means lizard. The dina is from a Greek word that means fearful or fear or terror or terrible. And thus, the word terrible lizards. Sometimes people wonder why in ancient versions they don't refer to dinosaurs. Well, the name wasn't even invented until 1842. They could not have referred to that very easily, since a version is supposed to take the words in the language that's being used and translate it in a way that will help those who are reading it. He called these terrible lizards. Not long after this, some American fossil hunters became very interested in this subject, and they began searching for fossils. In March of 1877, two schoolmasters stumbled onto these colossal bones projecting from the rocks in different sections of Colorado, and so it began. There has been an ongoing war ever since that time between evolutionists and creationists. The evolutionists saying that we need much, much time because, remember, their mentality says we started from a single-cell amoeba that just gradually changed, and it changed some more and changed some more, and over a period of many, many multiplied millions, maybe 4.5 billion years, this thing changed into the people that we see here and a number of other animals as well. The creations, of course, differ on that. The key element here is time. So it is absolutely indispensable for the evolutionary holder, the one who holds the evolutionary theory, to say that there is a great distinction in time between when the dinosaurs lived and when humans lived. The evolutionists claim that dinosaurs evolved from an ancient reptile some 200 million years ago. They became extinct 65 to 70 million years ago. And so we, man, are separated from the dinosaurs by several million years. We evolved, they say, 2 to 3 million years ago. So there's some 65 or so million years separating any human from any dinosaur. Now, what's this based on? Well, it's based on assumption, but not proof, which I hope to show this evening. It's interesting to me that some who profess to be Christians hold to this view. There's a man who puts out a booklet every couple of months on evidences. And he made this statement. If dinosaurs existed 200 million years before Adam and Eve, it does not present any problem to a literal understanding of the Genesis record. Think about that. It does not present a problem to the Genesis record. Well, it may not to him, but it does to anyone who reads Genesis to mean what it says. Now, as we look, and I give him four Pinocchios, by the way. He doesn't know it, but that's what I've given him. No fossil comes with a date stamped on the side saying made in China or made in Asia or whatever. They look at the fossil and they say, how old is this fossil? Well, it's 70 to 100 million years old. How do you know? Because the rock that it's in is that old. Well, how do you know the rock is that old? Well, because the fossil in it is that old. And so it's circular reasoning. And this is so common, it's almost comical if it weren't so serious and if so many weren't taken in by it. Now, we raise the question, why are dinosaurs important? Why should we even talk about dinosaurs in a series such as this? Well, first of all, because of the great interest in them, especially on the part of children. I have several grandchildren who I won't say that a day doesn't go by without them thinking of dinosaurs. I'd say probably a minute doesn't go by without them thinking of dinosaurs. I mean, there's some of them pretty obsessed with it. I don't mean in an evil or bad way, but they're just consumed with it. And they read everything they can read on the subject, and they hold to the truth on the subject. But they're just consumed with the thought of it. They don't want to be around any of them. They don't want to be in a field where some of them might be because they've seen the size of the teeth they are. But they love studying about them. The size of them, the power, the teeth, all compel interest. And children are very interested in this. Then there's the problem of indoctrination. From kindergarten to college, teachers use dinosaurs to prove an old earth. Birds today used to be dinosaurs. The dinosaurs evolved to the point that today they're the birds we see. That's the current theory. Jack Horner, who was the advisor to Jurassic, not Park, but I'll tell you in a minute. I have written down somewhere. That's one of his theories, and he's well known to hold this view. Birds are evolved from dinosaurs. This is all in an effort to teach that the earth is very old, has to be, or else the whole view of evolution goes down in flames. Children typically accept what the teachers say. Here you have a teacher who is well known to be a philanthropist. He's a kind person. He is a friend to his students. He takes them on field trips. He knows everything. And he tells them that one day he says, do you know the dinosaurs lived some 65 to 70 million years before there was ever a man? They lived millions and millions and millions of years ago. Little Tommy sitting in the back wonders what's going on here. And he says, my mom and dad said that the earth is not more than just a few thousand years old. And so he goes up to his desk and he pulls out a Bible, King James Version, and he starts reading, and he has a lot of these and thous and so on. And he says, now this book is good for the purpose for which it is written. It's written to teach us how to be saved. But it's not a science book. It's a good book, but it's not a science book. In fact, the men who wrote this book don't really know much about science at all. And they don't tell you how old the earth is. That's assumed by people who preach and teach. But it uses this these and thous and so on. It's an old book that was written before any real science even came into vogue. So you can't trust this book in science. When it comes to matters of how you should live and what you should believe in terms of doctrine to save your soul, well, yeah, that's the book you ought to go to. When it comes to how old the earth is and other things of science, this is not the book. It's an old, ancient, has-been. And they listen to this and they think, well, if our teacher says that, I suspect it's so. True story, our second son in kindergarten was taught by his teacher about dinosaurs having existed millions upon millions of years ago. And when Janet went to pick him up one day, he was thrilled to start talking about dinosaurs and how long ago they lived and all that. He just took it in hook, line, and sinker. She said, Dan, that's not true. That is not the way it was. And so we had to talk to him. By the time he got to the second grade, when the teacher brought up dinosaurs, he had not only had an answer, but was a little bit of a smart aleck about it, and she had to get on to him because she couldn't answer what he said. But I suggest to you that that goes on regularly, and it just continues to progress as they continue to grow. And it's not that the teachers are necessarily trying to ruin their faith in God, but if that's what it takes to push their theory, they're willing to do so. Stephen Jay Gould, along with Niles Eldridge, invented what evolutionists tend to call the punctuated equilibrium theory. Now, that is a fancy way of saying we have examined the record, and there are many missing links, and nobody's been able ever to find those missing links, even with all the tricks that some evolutionists tried to pull, the Piltdown hoax and all these others. They've resorted to a lot of trickery and lying through the years. This is all a matter of record. We don't have the missing links. So they came out with the punctuated equilibrium theory to say, we don't expect there to be a continuum from this little single cell amoeba up to this. Maybe what happened was you had this thing and then just boom, it just jumped way up here instead of going the logical route. And then it went along a little while and then just boom, did it again. It skipped a lot of spaces in between. Now the other evolutionists, Stephen Jay Gould is dead now, Niles Eldridge lives. But when they would propagate this theory, the evolutionists supported them in public, but behind their backs they laughed at them. How could they be so stupid? We know that's not the case. We will find these missing links. Just time is on our side. Just keep up the fight. But they didn't want to ridicule any evolutionists because they wanted to put on a united front and not look as though there are divisions among them. There are plenty of divisions among them. But Stephen Jay Gould says that he studied dinosaurs at a young age, and this is what steered him into evolution. This great man at Harvard became what he became because of what he learned as a boy studying dinosaurs. Your children studying dinosaurs in school, nothing wrong with that in itself, but the things that are added by teachers, the things that are assumed, there's where the problem begins. Edward O. Wilson is called the father of sociobiology. Brilliant man. When he was 15, he had a great fervor and interest in what he called fundamentalist religion. He left at age 17 to go to the University of Alabama. There he learned for the first time the evolutionary theory, and his faith went out the window and he forgot it for the rest of his life. And I wish I could say he was a single, solitary example and none other could be found. But if I were to, I would be deceiving you. He is one of a long line of people who have been deceived largely because of dinosaurs. His story is often repeated. Now, why is the Bible silent on this subject, people say? Why doesn't God, in His Word, set the record straight and tell us He knows about dinosaurs and that He created them and that man existed along with them? That would solve this issue for any believer in the Word of God. Well, the facts are this. Whatever the Bible discusses, it's accurate. But the Bible is not a zoology book. It was not intended to be. There are a number of animals that aren't mentioned in this book. It doesn't mention a cat or a kangaroo or a duck-billed platypus or a number of other animals. That's not its purpose. The purpose of a phone book is not to be handy in case you need first aid. Here's somebody choking. He gets meat hung in his throat. He says, oh, how do you do the Heimlich move? Let me turn to the phone book. And all you get is a bunch of numbers and things to call. That's not what the purpose of the phone book is. You need a first aid book. Hopefully you have it in your head before you meet that book. The purpose of this book is not merely to give us a list of animals. It does give us a list of some for various reasons, but that's not its main purpose. And then the word dinosaur did not exist until 1842. So when you look back at the Wycliffe English Bible that was written in 1392, that's 450 years before the word dinosaur was even invented. So if you're translating into the English language and you want to use the word dinosaur, you can't because it hasn't been invented yet. That's why it wouldn't be mentioned in that version. And the King James Version in 1611, that's 231 years before the word dinosaur. If the Bible does refer to dinosaurs, it must therefore use a different name than dinosaur. It wouldn't have to call them dinosaurs, just as we wouldn't have to call them dinosaurs. We could call them terrible lizards. That's what the name means. And still have some recognition of their existence along with man. And then third, some say the Bible does not refer to dinosaurs. Well, in view of the fact that the word was not in existence at the time, most of our versions were given, how would they know? How would they know if it uses it or not? In fact, there are several passages. I want to focus on two this evening. But there are several passages that speak of animals that certainly would fit into the category of what we would call terrible lizards. In Genesis 1, verse 21, for example, you will see when God is creating on this day, this is the fifth day, verse 21 of Genesis 1, God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. What is involved in that great sea creature category? There have been some dinosaurs that we know that were ocean goers, apparently. This word, as in Job 7, verse 12 as well, where Job says, am I a sea or a sea serpent that you set a guard over me? Now, when he says, am I a sea, he's asking God why he's being punished the way he is. And he says, am I a sea? What does a sea do? Well, a sea sometimes has storms and it terrifies people and it causes them to drown. Am I like a sea, something that was greatly feared in the ancient world, that I cause horror and terror and make people afraid? Is that the kind of person I am? And then he says, or a sea serpent? He believed there were such things as sea serpents, that you set a guard over me. Why are you constantly guarding me? So the word here in both of these instances means a sea monster, sea dragon, that is a serpent-like monster, a sea serpent. Psalm 148, verse 7, puts it in a little bit different form. Psalm 148, 7, praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures and all the depths. And then in Isaiah 30, at verse 6, one of the interesting things that Isaiah does, he refers to a number of animals and people and places and nations to help his people understand what they're doing to themselves and how terrible things may happen if they don't straighten out. Isaiah 30, verse 6, the burden against the beasts of the south. So this is an oracle or a prophecy here to Egypt. He says, through a land of trouble and anguish from which come the lioness, and lion, the viper, and fiery flying serpent. What is a fiery flying serpent? Do we look at the word lioness and lion and say, well, those are just make-believe animals. They never existed. Nobody takes that view. We've seen those. The viper, we take the position that's a fictitious animal. Nobody does. But then do you think he's going to add a fictitious animal with these other live ones and real ones? When he says a fiery flying serpent, you think there are such things? Well, there certainly were. That's what he says is characteristic of what we expect. These flying serpents once lived. The exact identity unknown, but the flying serpents once lived. Now, Job finally gets his wish. If you'll go with me to the book of Job, you'll see that what's happening here is Job has gone through a loss that most of us cannot comprehend. In one fell swoop, he's lost all of his property. The richest man on Wall Street has suddenly become absolutely bankrupt. He's also lost his children, 10, 7 boys and 3 girls, in one fell swoop as the wind hits their house where they're having a birthday party and it kills them. So he's lost everything. He shaves his head. He says, I came out of the womb naked and I'll go back the same way. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He doesn't curse God and die like his wife in chapter 2 tells him to, because by that time, Satan has also had permission now to afflict his body. He is hurting. He is suffering all over his body. From his head to his feet, he is suffering. And he has wounds, oozing sores. He would scrape himself to try to relieve himself. And he sits on the ash heap and he puts ash on his head as a sign of mourning. And throughout this narrative where he's discussing these things with his supposed friends. They're quiet for 7 days. They were very good comforters when they didn't open their mouths. It's very good not to say anything if you don't know what to say. Then when they started speaking, it was to accuse Job. He must have done something evil, because if not, if this is a good man suffering this way, then we're also vulnerable. This could happen to us. But we'd like to believe that this is a man who looked good outwardly but was really a hypocrite, and he's suffering, and therefore we're safe because we're not hypocrites and we are good men. We can't suffer like this. That's just not right. That's not true. Good people do suffer. And Jesus points that out repeatedly. John 9, the man who's born blind is not because he did something wrong. And the people in Luke 13 on whom the tower fell and whose blood was sacrificed along with their sacrifices when Pilate's men killed them, he said, do you think these are the worst people around? Of course not. Those people standing on the tower, you think those are the 18 worst people on earth? That's why that happened to them? No, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Ecclesiastes speaks of this. Many other passages. The righteous suffer. Greatest illustration is Jesus himself. The righteous do suffer. But Job doesn't understand all this. God doesn't tell him why this has happened. And so he keeps saying, if only I could have an audience with God, I would ask him this, I would ask him that. And so finally in chapter 38, God comes out of the whirlwind and he says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man, I will question you, and you shall answer me. Then he starts out, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding, who determined its measurements? Before we criticize God, we better stop and realize he may start quizzing us. God questions and Job withers. The issue is, before we criticize him, we have to know at least as much as he knows and be able to do at least as much as he does, or else we don't have the right to question God. We're his creatures. God shows his power and wisdom that produced his creation, and Job seeks unconditional surrender. God says, gird up your loins, you have a little bit more to hear yet. So, in chapter 40, God starts speaking to Job about a mighty animal known as Behemoth. This is a word that is used several times. We've seen one reference to it already. This is in Job. I have 41 on there, but it's 40. I put the wrong number, so put that down to my error. Job 40, verses 15 through 24, 15 to the end of the chapter. This word is an intensive plural. It is a plural form of the word. The behemah would be the singular. This is behemot. I'm not trying to be technical, but it's just simply that thing. It is a word that generally refers to beasts in general, as in Isaiah 13, verse 21. It can refer to just normal cows, horses, any kind of beast. But in the plural form, as it's used here, this was a common way the Hebrews wrote if they wanted to make something very great, very powerful. They put it in the plural form with singular verbs and singular pronouns, and it's referring to one great beast. And so the behemoth is what they would say, is the big creature under consideration. The translators didn't know this beast's identity, so they left it untranslated. They transliterated it. We talked, I think, on Sunday morning about the word baptism wasn't translated by our versions. It was transliterated. They took the Greek word for baptism and just put those letters over into English. The word Hades, they didn't translate. They just transliterated. They brought those letters for Hades right over into the English, gave them English letters. And we have several things like that. All the names are that way. They're transliterated. Behemoth is a transliteration from the Hebrew letters to the English letters without giving a translation. I don't know that they would have known how to translate it. But the fact of the matter is, some identify this beast. They assume that it is a hippopotamus. The American Standard footnote will say this is a hippopotamus. The New King James footnote is more accurate, saying that it is a large animal, exact identity unknown. The English Standard does the same thing. The Revised Standard does worst of all. It says, this portrait of Behemoth, like that of Leviathan, may have received literary amplification, but it plays an integral part of the poet's purpose. The creating God is in control of all forces of evil, despite appearances to the contrary. The primeval monster is not a mere hippopotamus. He says it is a hippopotamus, but it's not just a hippopotamus, but a mythical symbol. Leviathan is not an ordinary crocodile, but the sea monster. It's only a plaything in the eyes of God. Well, in the context, it cannot be a hippopotamus. It does not refer to a hippopotamus here, and we'll see why as we go along. Now, in verses 15 to 16, Job 40, verse 15, look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He's asking Job to look at this thing. Job knows what this is. Job is living as this thing is living. And he expects him to be able to comprehend what God is about to say about it. Look at now at the behemoth which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. Just as an ox actually eats grass, this thing, whatever it is, actually eats grass. And he says, furthermore, see now his strength is in his hips. And his power is in his stomach muscles. A very common statement about various animals. So, he says, this is one that I made with you, verse 15. If Job is real, this animal is real. So that much is very clear. In verse 17, he moves his tail like a cedar. Have you ever seen the tail on a hippo? If you haven't, look at the tail on a pig. We raised pigs. We never raised hippos, but we raised pigs. We never had a single person come to our farm and look at the biggest pig we had and say, look at him swing that tail. Oh, it's like a cedar tree. No, it's a wimpy little thing. And if you look at the tail on a hippo, it's the wimpiest part of it. You would look at that and say, that reminds me of a tree swaying in the wind. Whoa, that's a powerful instrument. Get out of the way of that tail there. Now, Francis Anderson, in the Tyndale series, who identifies his creature as a hippo, admits this. He says, it is hard to see how his tail can be compared to a cedar. For the tail of a hippopotamus is small and short. That says something. Maybe you have the wrong animal you're trying to push here. But one man, years ago, said, well, probably it's a hippo. He didn't know. And the others said, well, that sounds good to me. We don't know what it is, so let's just call it a hippo. And they just jump into the pile. In verse 18, his bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Now, when you look at this creature, he is the first, which means the chief in size and might of God's work. When you think about this, consider that a hippo is about 4 tons and 7 feet high. An elephant, about twice the size of a hippo. Now, an apatosaurus is about 30 tons and 3 stories high. Now, did any of you ever see the Flintstones? Or am I the only one that old? I'm willing to admit I'm ancient. Remember Fred Flintstone riding around in his car? Remember that? And what was the great dinosaur? What kind of bird would they eat? Brontosaurus, right? The brontosaurus and the apatosaurus are the same. They didn't know that. The apatosaurus was named first, early in the 1900s. Then they saw another creature and they named it the brontosaurus. Then they got to look and they said, no, these are the same. Well, since the apatosaurus was named first, they said, we better call this the apatosaurus. So if you say brontosaurus, people are going to think you've been watching the Flintstones. If you say apatosaurus, it means you're up on your science. So take whatever position you want on that. But look how big this is. There are some creatures whose bones suggest something much larger than a hippopotamus. In fact, the Argentinosaurus is 100 plus tons and 120 feet long. But I didn't have room on the chart for something that big. Now, in 19b, second part of verse 19, only he who made him can bring near his sword. No one could approach him with a sword. No one could capture him. That's not true of hippopotamuses. They brought swords to hippos. They captured hippos. Egypt was well known for this. Egyptian monuments show warriors attacking a hippo single-handed. Egyptians celebrated harpooning the hippopotamus festivals. They had festivals where they harpooned these things. I don't think they ever had behemoth festivals where I've harpooned one of these things. You wouldn't want to. Now, in verse 24, he goes on to say, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare. There's no river, no thing anywhere. These are certainly great creatures, but they're not fictitious. They're observable, like the rest of the Lord's questions deal with real animals. And so we must conclude that no creature on earth today that we see fits this description. Now we go to chapter 41 for real and look at Leviathan. And this is in chapter 41, starting at verse 1. Leviathan is defined as a reptile, serpent-like creature of the sea that takes on mythological proportions. It is a sea creature. It is a dragon, a sea monster, ASV and the NASB and the Revised Standard, a monster of the deep, the NIV, the sea serpent, the New King James, the New American Standard Bible and others, and the footnotes say are the crocodile. And whereas they primarily tried to make the behemoth a rhino, they've tried to make Leviathan a crocodile. And I don't think this is going to fit any better than their attempt to fit what they did with the behemoth in the previous chapter. The New King James footnote has one of the best comments of all. A large sea creature, exact identity unknown. So here's what some refer to as a sea monster, the monster of the deep, the sea serpent, and so on. But the context does not imply a crocodile. The Septuagint gives a verb here instead of an animal. It gives a verb that means something that is extraordinarily impressed or disturbed by something, meaning a wonder, a marvel, something out of this world in sight and in power. So the context is not a crocodile, but we'll see more about that as we go along. The first six verses, can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose? Or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? That is, will he beg for release and say, please let me go, I don't want to be here? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will he say, I have a deal, you let me go and I'll do this? Will you take him as a servant forever? Can you just take him, make him do what you want? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Think you can sell him somewhere? This creature could not be captured. He could not be domesticated, but crocodiles could, and they were. Crocodiles were hunted by the Egyptians. Crocodiles were captured by them, and some of them were even tamed as pets. Imagine having a pet crocodile. Wouldn't that be great for intruders? Don't come in, I have a crocodile. In verses 7 through 11, it overwhelmed men. And so he says in verse 7, can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? That is, if this animal overwhelmed men like this, who can resist God? And he goes on down in verse 12. I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They're joined one to another. They stick together and cannot be parted. The scales as armor, and you have the terrifying teeth. And then verse 18, his sneezings flash forth light. And his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and a flame goes out of his mouth. He goes out of his way to talk about his ability of sneezing fire and smoke. Now, people look upon this at first glance and say, well, surely God is exaggerating. Let us stop for a moment and realize what we have in this part of Job. The first couple of chapters are God and Satan, and then Job and his wife and others responding to what has happened. From chapter 3 on through this part where God starts to speak up to chapter 38, there's a lot of error. Job says some things that he has to take back later, and his three friends are filled with error. They're filled with error, and Job has to pray for them that they might be forgiven for what they've taught. So that part of Job is not only not inspired in the sense that God gave them the words to say, he did not. He has to rebuke them for their words. And that's in chapter 40, in 41 and 42. But notice, this is God speaking. This is God speaking directly to Job. And he says that this animal has these lights, these sparks of fire, this smoke that goes out, his breath kindles coals, flame goes out of his mouth. I don't know why that should give us a problem, really, because when you think about it, fireflies produce light. I think that's a rather marvelous thing we see and just take for granted. We know that eels produce electricity. We know that bombardier beetles produce an explosive chemical reaction. Those things had to come together at the same time in the same beetle to be able to produce that reaction. It's an irreducibly complex system. They all had to be together at the same time in each beetle. But if they could do all this, would it be so shocking if God were to create an animal that we might call something like a dragon that would breathe forth fire? And then would it surprise us when we start looking all around the world for thousands of years? China, Peru, the British Isles, we could name place after place. This was part of part two that we won't go into. Have not only traditions about these fire-breathing dragons and the flying serpents and things of this nature, but also have drawings they've made independent of one another. Even the American Indians have some. And these go back hundreds, sometimes thousands of years. They are by the thousands, some 5,000 or so just in one area of Mexico. And all of them testify that they've seen all these things. They've seen these fire breathers and so on. And some fought for them. Marco Polo comes back saying, I saw these things. I saw the look in their eyes, and I saw what they could do to people. And so it wouldn't surprise us if God says, this is what I made. After all, God is the one who's the creature. Any creature he makes is so complex that we'll never figure it out, even the human body. Now, when you look at 22 to 24, strength dwells in his neck, and sorrow dances before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They're firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone. Even as hard as the lower millstone. And he's pointing out there that the mightiest of men are afraid of this creature, afraid to be in his territory. In 25, when he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid because of his crashings there beside themselves. Now let's think about it for a minute. How long are the legs on a crocodile? Are they so long that when he raises himself up, you look up to look into his eyes and say, oh, this is frightening? No, he's short. He's very short. And so I don't know that that would be said of a crocodile. He has the short legs. Furthermore, in verse 26, though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail. Nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw, and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potchers. He spreads pointed marks in the mire. And when you look at this, the weapons are useless against him. I never saw a crocodile that had this kind of underside. And furthermore, they could be vulnerable to spears and javelins. Their underside is easily pierced and is not like sharp potchers. Remember the old Tarzan movies? When he'd jump in the water and he would grab, I don't know if it was an alligator or a crocodile in his position, I guess a crocodile. But he would hold it and he would stab it, the underside, and it would die and he would walk away. And you remember also on a number of occasions the famous Steve Irwin, who had shows on TV about animals, showing that he wasn't afraid of poisonous snakes or anything else before he was killed by a stingray. He would sit on one end of an alligator, and his wife sat on the other end. You can do this to these creatures, but you don't see this taking place in regard to this animal that God speaks of. Furthermore, you'll notice in verses 31 and 32, he moved easily through the water. Makes the deep boil like a pot, makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. Most crocodiles swim in rivers, and they swim stealthily, but some in the ocean, but not in the way you see here. And then, no creature on earth could cause such dread. On earth there is nothing like him which is made without fear. In 34, he beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. I don't know that I would say, as in verse 34, he beholds every high thing. A crocodile is low in regard to height, so I don't know how that would be said of them. T.K. Shane espoused a mythological interpretation of Job 40:41. He said, no modern animal fits the description. But the mythological view that he espouses causes greater problems. Are other animals in this context mythological too? We know no modern animal fits the description, not one that we know. The Egyptians conquered the crocodiles, made them pets, speared them and all this, but this animal couldn't be treated that way. So, no modern animal fits this. Are other animals mentioned here mythological too? When in fact in chapter 39, verse 1, he mentions the wild mountain goats. Are they fictitious? Are the deer, verse 1? Are the wild donkey in verse 5? Are the wild ox in verse 9? Are the ostrich in verse 13? Are the horse in verse 19? Or the hawk or the eagle and the others that he mentions? They're all real. Why would we assume that this is a myth that he's giving us here? The mythological view caused greater problems. What if God never actually made these animals? It's just a myth. What would Job say? He'd say, what's the point? You're telling me how great you are because of these great animals that you've created when in fact you never created them at all. It would destroy God's own argument for it to be the mythological interpretation. God would be bluffing. He's like the man who brags about how he was a Vietnam War hero and he never set foot in Vietnam. And people hear that and they say, that's disgusting. And it ought to be. But God surely wouldn't do something like this, would he? Of course not. In Exodus 20, at verse 11, when God is speaking about the fourth commandment of remembering the Sabbath day to keep it holy, he says this, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all. A-L-L, all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Here's all of creation in the 6 day period. The seventh day he rested. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now, this is a summary of the creation account of Genesis 1. He created all that is in them in 6 days. The sea and the air creatures on the fifth day. Sea creatures and birds on the fifth day. The land animals on the sixth day along with man. Now, you remember the statement made in Job 40, verse 15, that this creature, Behemoth, I made along with you. I made man and Behemoth on the same day. Job learned his lesson. We serve an incredibly powerful God. You know how powerful he is? Look at Leviathan. And Leviathan, as strong and sturdy and powerful as he is, cannot come close to being as powerful as his creator. And the same thing true of Leviathan. Leviathan and Behemoth show Job learned his lesson. He begs God for mercy. Now, one more thing. Evolutionists claim some 65 million years at least between us and these creatures. Mary Schweitzer, a very well-known scientist, paleontologist at the University of Montana at the time in 2011, was given some eggs and other material. They had you crack open the bones they found from digging up and crack open the eggs. No other paleontologist was doing this because they said, we don't want to ruin these things. And Jack Horner, he was the advisor to, I can't remember which one it was. At any rate, I'll give it to you in a minute. He's the one who said, go ahead and open them up because glue is cheap and we can glue these things back together. So she got these things open. And once she did, she found these wonderful blood vessels and blood itself within that little section of dinosaur egg or bone. His name is Jack Horner, advisor to Jurassic World. That's the word I couldn't get a while ago. So Jurassic World. Don't forget that, because I probably will. But the red blood vessels and the blood vessels and the red blood cells in a 68 million year old dino, and when she pulled it, it was still elastic. It sprang back. And the question was raised, how could this be 68 million years old? Did they change their view about an old Earth? No. They didn't change their view about an old Earth. What they did was fire her from her job because she found these things. She's no longer at the University of Montana. She's in North Carolina. She still goes to Montana to dig. She is a believer in God. She says, and I believe she is. She's a nice lady. She is one who goes to church regularly. But she says, I like to think of God who did not just something in a few days, but over a period of eons. And that makes him a greater God. How sad. You don't make God greater than he already is. God's way is always the best way. And what God could do in 6 days shows he's great enough to have done in that short period of time and not have to stretch it out so long. World Book. Dragons of legend are strangely like actual creatures that have lived in the past. They're much like the great reptiles which inhabited the earth long before man is supposed to have appeared on earth. Dragons were generally evil and destructive. Every country had them in its mythology. Every one of them had it. Dragons were generally evil and destructive. Every country had them. They are drawn to describe with uniformity. Get that. People who hadn't communicated with one another and over a period of many different years, many different centuries, are doing these things. Alexander the Great comes back from India. There's a dragon inside a cave he talks about. Fire-breathing dragon that people are scared to death of. And this is true all over the country, all over the world. The worldwide flood. If the flood altered Earth's canopy vapor, you remember that vertical separation, so the water here and the water up there, and the sun is blocked by virtue of this great canopy up there. Is that why man lived so long and creatures grew so large? And is it possible that once that was removed from its position, that you start to see in the very next chapters of Genesis, man's life starts getting shorter, animals start getting smaller, apparently. So that when you look at a Komodo dragon, is that on the chart? Yes. You know what that looks like to me? Terrible lizard. You know what a terrible lizard is? A lot of people would call that a dinosaur. And they're alive today. And there are many, many other things that are alive that are just like this. 99% of Earth's species, we're told, are extinct. History points, if that's anywhere close to being right, history points to one great cause. And that's the Great Flood that we spoke of. Some would have survived because apparently there could have been some small ones on the ark with Noah. But what we do know is that whatever God says is true. And whatever these creatures are, the behemoth and the leviathan, they certainly sound like what we would call dinosaurs. Terrible lizards. Whatever they are, they're there with man. Job is supposed to know these creatures. Men have certain views toward them. They're scared to death of them. They know them intimately. There wasn't a separation of millions of years between man and these, whatever they are. So if they're not dinosaurs, they're just as good, and the same point would stand. Thank you very much for your excellent attention. It could be that someone in this audience has never obeyed the gospel of Christ. We would invite you to come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. His word is true. Repent of your sins. Confess your faith in him. Be buried with him in baptism. Rise and walk in that new life and serve him, and he'll take you to be with him in heaven. Won't you come all together? We stand and sing.